honourable members, just firstly my apologies to you. I know that at yesterday's meeting we agreed, or I had said we wouldn't deal with harassment, but on reflection later I realised that perhaps we would need to continue with it. Some of you have indicated to me that you've not brought your notes and everything else dealing with harassment. I understand that, and I'll afford you an opportunity to slip out and get them if necessary. We have in our presence Mr. Hovey. Mr. Hovey, I'm given to understand, is an expert in the field of child trafficking. And so he's going to speak to us this morning and give us some of his experiences and his knowledge, and we hope to derive some reward from that, and then we'll take questions for clarity and any comment thereafter. Mr. Hovey, welcome.
Thank you very much. Would it be possible if I could move to the center over there in the group?
No, no problem whatsoever.
Thank you.
Yeah, just clarify that saying in expert in combating trafficking.
My apologies, of course. Combating, not participating in or.
Is it possible then for him not to sit that side, so that, I mean, the members of this side, so that, that
yeah,
we can see him when he speaks?
Oh, you want him here?
Yeah.
All right.
Is that fine?
Yeah.
Morning, JD.
Sorry.
Thank you very much.
Next to the gentleman in the red tie, his name is Mr. Bassett.
Mr. Bassett.
Yes, I think.
And I represent an organization called the International Association of Crimes Against Children, the IACAC. And we are coming here to offer our assistance, our expertise, our help to South Africa. We are currently in 60 countries all over the world, and we've been in operations for almost 15 years. The trafficking of human beings is today the third largest source of income for organized crime in the world. It's next only to the illicit sales of weapons and drugs. The trafficking of children is a very, very large percentage of that statistic. We estimate that over 20 million children are enslaved or involved in prostitution, child pornography, and child trafficking, and that the numbers are increasing each year by an additional 1.2 million worldwide. This is very sensitive to me. I work with children all over the world. I've been in many, many different countries. And last week, in the Johannesburg area, I met with five girls that nobody knows about that had been enslaved in prostitution here in Africa. One of them, for 3 months, had been kept in an upper room with a bunch of other girls and forced to have sexual relations with men 6 to 7 times a day. This is happening all over the world. It's happening in Los Angeles. It's happening in Washington, the state of Washington. It's happening all over the place. It's happening in Amsterdam. It's worldwide. It's almost impossible to calculate actual figures because we don't have adequate access to reliable statistics in some countries for example, like South Africa. But the tragic practice of child trafficking and sex tourism is now widespread because of the enormous profits involved for major organized crime. What we do know is that a vast number of children are being trafficked outside of South Africa to become slaves in prostitution, pornography, child labor, and the recent proliferation of young people being trafficked for their organs is truly alarming. Our organization, the IACAC, like I've said, the International Agency for Crimes Against Children, functions on a global basis to gather intelligence and evidence for the interdiction of organized crime syndicates and individuals that profiteer from the trafficking, from the enslavement and sexual exploitation of children for prostitution, pornography, forced labor, organ trafficking, and other crimes. These criminal entities not only exploit children in real environments, they have also created a highly sophisticated subculture in cyberspace on both the supply and the demand side that is extremely difficult to track and intercept. Their illicit dealings in child exploitation are often related to other criminal activities, including intimidation, murder, corruption of political and governmental figures, international money laundering, identity theft, and the fraudulent use of financial instruments such as stolen credit or debit cards, anonymous online payment utilities, offshore banking systems, and various other methods of securing illicit payments. The IACAC also targets the demand side of the exploitation of children by tracking the activities of sex tourism operators and their clientele, as well as the individuals physically preying on children. This includes the gathering of evidence on such groups or individuals based on verifiable observation and testimony by victims, and by tracking the activities of child pornographers on both the demand and the supply side. While collaborating with many governments in the fight against the trafficking and exploitation of children and related crimes, the IACAC is an entirely independent organization and is not the branch or agent of any government or political entity, religious group, international organization, international community, or commonwealth. We are completely independent. The IACAC functions with five distinct mandates. One is to gather the intelligence and evidence for the interdiction of organized crime rings and individuals that profiteer from the trafficking, enslavement, and sexual exploitation of children for prostitution, pornography, forced labor, and other crimes against humanity, both in real and virtual environments. The IACAC also catalyzes the effects of existing laws, such as the United States of America's Protect Act of 2003, the United Kingdom's Sexual Offenses Act of 2003, by tracking and monitoring the activities, both in real and cyberspace, of individuals or groups of individuals traveling across international borders for the purposes of having sex with minors. To facilitate, and the second function is to facilitate the rescue, safety, and rehabilitation of missing, exploited, enslaved, and endangered children by the way of IACAC's highly secure data system designed to consolidate information and collaborate with national and international agencies in the search for children. The third function is to compile and disseminate image arrays, not just to other agencies with IACAC's collaborates, but also to the general public, to assist in locating and identifying criminals involved in the exploitation and trafficking of children. This includes the broadcasting of image arrays of known predators and persons of interest. The fourth function is to play a proactive and dynamic role in raising awareness of the issue of child exploitation in the global media through concerned or sympathetic organizations, and to enlist the help of the public in a wide variety of arenas in apprehending known or fugitive offenders, or reporting known or alleged crimes against children. And the fifth function is to compile and disseminate empirical data on the global issue of child exploitation and trafficking to both governmental and non-governmental entities, and to continually monitor compliance by countries that have ratified or are parties to international conventions and treaties, and provisions relating to the trafficking and exploitation of persons, especially children. It is with this last regard, this last mandate, that I am here today to offer our services to the South African government and the Endangered Partnership, in an endangered partnership, and with a charter to help formulate and actually instigate an effective tactical initiative to stop child trafficking, indeed all kinds of human trafficking of South African citizens that are being used to serve this sordid multi-billion dollar industry. We also can be a great assistance with the domestic child exploitation issues within South Africa itself. How can we do this? Well, first of all, we need to have an agreement in the form of a charter from the South African Minister of Justice that authorizes the IAC to collaborate with an existing or newly formed entity within the South African government or in law enforcement whose singular task is to address this problem aggressively and with a coordinated, well-planned strategy. There's no need, however, to reinvent the wheel. We have already established the architecture by building our fully scalable, highly efficient, and very secure data system that can be adapted, expanded, and upgraded. It's been explained to me that it's actually 5 times more secure than the FBI's system. The IACAC's data system is a remarkable tool because it's the first time a global entity has been developed that gathers detailed, empirical information, converged in a highly secure, centralized system, accessible by those dedicated to combating child exploitation and saving children. I use the word empirical here on contrast with the vast amount of data currently available that is, frankly, either out of date or simply not reliable because of the way it was gathered. And because the IACAC is already fully operational in over 60 countries with a sophisticated system in place, a joint initiative between South Africa and the IACAC can be relatively quick to put into operation without huge cost to the South African people. I would propose the following for us to proceed. One, the IACAC needs an official charter from the South African government to act collaboratively with a governmental entity, such as the Minister of Justice, tasked with aggressively dealing with the issues of human trafficking and enslavement, especially that of children. This would be an officially recognized charter with full details of the collaboration between the IACAC and South Africa. The charter must also be assigned international recognition by South Africa's diplomatic missions and representatives abroad of IACAC's status as a proxy intelligence gathering entity for the South African people and its government. The IACAC will set up an interim draft charter of IACAC's costs for development and ratification by both parties to the charter. Such a collaboration initiative must otherwise be funded entirely by the South African government, and a budget must therefore be developed as soon as possible and ratified by due process. Again, the IACAC will assist in formulating such a budget. Once inaugurated, the IACAC and the South African entity will design and develop a plan of action, appoint key figures and empowered authority, and put in place all necessary communications and security protocols to begin operations. Right now, these are quite weak within this country. I've spoken with several people in the law enforcement agency and security personnel, and this is an area of concern. With a common charter, IACAC and the South African entity will commence operations together, and in the initial stages will strive to establish a status quo with real empirical data on the current state of human trafficking within to or from South Africa today. When a status quo has been ascertained, IACAC will assist in launching a long-term effective strategy for South Africa to implement measures to addressing human trafficking. Finally, I'd like to mention that the IACAC can play a significant role in South Africa's ascendancy from its current trafficking person status as a Tier 2 country to a Tier 1, with all that tier's implications in terms of foreign aid and support in general. By becoming a Tier 1 country and with strict adherence to international treaties and conventions on the trafficking of human beings, South Africa will become significantly more appealing as far as international aid and cooperation is concerned. I've taken great risks to come here to you today and speaking. I don't normally do this. I have sort of exposed myself to you. I've been undercover for 13 years. This is the first group I've come to and show myself in presence. I know there are major people throughout the world that are praying on these children. And as I've said before, I've held them in my arms and worked with them at great length. This is why I risk myself today by coming to you and expose who I am and who we are. Because I believe, excuse me, we can help hundreds of thousands of more kids than what we're doing right now here in South Africa alone. Thank you for your time. Do you have any questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Levy. All right, there's a forest of hands. Professor Navandaba, Debbie Schaefer, Mr. John Jeffrey. Prof?
Thank you, Chair. We congratulate Mr. Obia for his enlightenment. It's a very sensitive issue. But having said that, Chair, I just want to bring clarity on a few points. Now, the children that are trafficked from South Africa
to other countries, is this a one-way process or a two-way process? If you could just clear for us whether there are any children traveling from other countries to South Africa and vice versa. And if yes, what would be the incidence roughly, of these vices? Secondly, Chair, how big is the IEC in terms of staffing and organizational structure? It will help us to know that. Thank you, Chair.
Again, we are, first off, there are children being taken out of South Africa that are South African children, and there are children coming into South Africa that are not South African children. I know kids that are being placed in containers, shipping containers, with a bucket of water and a bucket for a toilet and sent over to Greece. Last time I was here, I actually talked with a group of people who had gotten information, and I was just setting up operations here, who had gotten information that there was a group of Nigerians that were trying to purchase white South African girls to be sent back children to for their purposes. I actually know that in an email that went out to a whole bunch of people, and the person who sent it to him is highly regarded within the industry, and nobody responded back to his email. Not one person. The IACAC, I don't disclose how big we are. We are in 60 countries. That gives you an idea of how large we are. We are the largest in the world at doing what we do. In fact, nobody really does what we do. I currently take care of 54,000 children within our system alone that we provide things for, everything for. I have children in colleges in the States. I have children in Eastern Europe, Western Europe, all over the South America, all over the world. We have relationships with large pharmaceutical companies that help us with antiviral drugs for kids, because a lot of these kids will have AIDS. One of the children I spoke with this last week has AIDS and needs to get treatment for those AIDS. She's not getting it. We will provide that for her. Does that answer your question, sir? Thank you.
Thank you. Similarly, I mean, we're busy at the moment dealing with the trafficking bill in order to comply with some of our international obligations, which is why I was hoping that you would be able to give us some actual... I know you can't get actual statistics. We all know that they aren't easy to get, and we have exactly the same problem in our own country. And we part of our discussions around the bill is what is the actual extent in South Africa. Do you have any idea as to how many children are trafficked to or from South Africa, where they are kept, are there any specific areas that we need to concentrate on, and so on. And even internationally, if you haven't got enough info here yet, there are a lot of figures bandied around by UN and various other organizations. Are those on track? Are they basically accurate? Please.
as I stated in my statements here, the data that's being given is not as accurate as it should be. Our data comes from boots on the ground, people on the ground, and we do not exaggerate our data. We have to take estimates in certain areas due to what's happening in other locations, but that's based on empirical data. We physically go talk to the NGOs, we physically talk to victims, we physically work within the agencies there. And there are people here in this country. Please be aware, this is a worldwide epidemic. And these people are integrated worldwide. You will pull a string in Bucharest, and it will end up over here in South Africa. You will pull a string in America, and it will go to Germany, and then it will touch over into Africa. It is worldwide. These people are very connected all over the world. And it's a very violent industry. And that's why I say we've been threatened. I've been threatened many times.
Chair, my question is on a similar level. I mean, as you, I'm sure, know, we're dealing with legislation on trafficking. One element is to tighten the criminal law. That's relatively easy. But the other is an issue of resources, state resources, that should be allocated to trafficking. Versus allocated to other issues. I mean, it's in the same category as sexual offences and general criminal justice. So you put too much emphasis on trafficking. At the moment, those other areas may suffer. And the difficulty we're facing is that we can't as legislators. Make requirements in legislation without knowing the extent of the problem. And we need statistics. Now, you haven't, Ms. Schaefer asked you weren't able to give a response. My question would be, okay, fine, if we don't have the statistical data in South Africa, can you give us data from other countries? What about America? What about the EU? Greece, if you talk about children being trafficked to Greece, what about Greece? It's no use to come with anecdotes. I mean, you did refer to I think it was, what is the term you used? Now I've lost my piece of paper, but it was something along the lines of evidence, verifiable evidence. But then it was sort of like, but that's what we basically need is sort of proper information. Proper data to know the extent of the problem. Then you talk about an alarming amount of trafficking going on in South Africa and that you personally know about your personal experiences. Are you giving information to the police? If not, why not? These children being trafficked to Greece. Has that been reported to the police? If not, then why? And then the other issue would be, what is your relationship? I mean, you come here wanting a, you're undercover. You're not wanting to disclose much about your organization, yet you want a agreement between your organization that we can't get told much about and the South African government. Mm. There's a number of there's international treaties on trafficking. There's a number of international organizations that are open. There are a number of organizations in South Africa. I don't know what your relationship is like with them, whether you've got any structured relationship with them. So really those would be my concerns. Also maybe one point, I mean, if you look at our constitution, it's not particularly, unlike some countries, you spoke about a problem of South African citizens being trafficked. It's not about our constitution is not, there are not that many rights that citizens have and nobody else has. It basically applies to the people in the country, which is a good thing. So it doesn't really matter if it is a South African citizen being trafficked to another country or a foreigner who happened to be here, who then got trafficked in or got trafficked out, the same things would basically apply. But basically, in short, we need statistics. Maybe it's difficult to have statistics from South Africa. I'm not quite sure why, But everybody seems to say that's a problem. But at least can you give us statistics from other countries that have them? Two, your anecdotal experiences, are they being reported to the law enforcement agencies? And if not, why not? And then three, it's a little bit difficult. Well, what's your relationship with trafficking coalitions, trafficking NGOs in South Africa? Is there a structured relationship?
Thank you. I appreciate you asking the questions here. In response to the statistics, the empirical data is not here in South Africa. We have some data. I know some people that are functioning here within your country that are connected worldwide that are very serious people. We can provide you data for other parts of the world, other age areas and whatnot. We can also, what I'm proposing and what I propose today is to actually work with you in gathering that empirical data here so you can have a good hand of what's going on. We're willing to work with you on achieving that. We'd love to do that so you can get more specific data.
Sorry, can I just raise on that? I don't know if you need to work with us, just if you've got data from other countries, then if you can submit that data to us and we can see, do you know which countries it is?
We have several countries that we're in. I'll have my people provide that to you. With the empirical data. But again, I would really like to focus on getting that data up here within South Africa so you can have a handle of what's going on with this, which actually applies to the tier process as well. I'd love to get that together, and we can work with you on doing that. In regards to the international organization and not being presenting ourselves out there in a sense too much, we are not looking for accolades. We're really not out there for that. We don't garner funds. We don't accept funds from governments. Because this, we need to be underground with what we've been doing in a lot of the areas. We have very strong relationships with a lot of governments, and perhaps we can share some of those with you. You could verify us through Interpol. They know who we are, and we could provide that information to you to how to do that. If you just call up and ask, they won't tell you who we are. But if we work through that, we can confirm that through Interpol. Or I can have federal judges in the United States contact you to tell you who we are and what we do. We have 18 operatives that just monitor our computers because these guys try and get into our computers 6 to 7 times a day, physically try and break in. But I have 18 people 24 hours a day that are monitoring just our computers, and that will give you a little bit of the size that we are. We address each of the situations that we come across. When the shipping container goes to Greece, for example, we work with the government's people over there. But again, the governments are corrupt in a lot of different areas. Your law enforcement here has issues. I think you all are aware of that. Girls recently went up to law enforcement that were enslaved in prostitution and said, not girls, but women, and said they've taken our passports. We have been forced into prostitution. Can you help us? And the police officers told them, you go back to your pimps, because if you don't have your passports, we're going to throw you in prison. And the girls don't quite know what to do when they face that type of stuff. So we need to work with that, and it's part of the things that we have to deal with. And it's not just South Africa that has that issue. There are a lot of other countries as well.
My difficulty is, I mean, it's okay, I'd like to know about the shipping container to Greece that you spoke about and what you did with it. But on that example that you've given us, which presumably they then came to you or you got to hear about it, I mean, what the police did, if they did that, was unlawful. There's mechanisms within the police. There may be corruption, but you've got your independent complaints directorate. You've got other bodies, public protector. You know, we can't address the problem if it's not reported.
I understand that.
You know, there may be fear, but numerous cases, numerous allegations against the police get reported, action gets taken against them, and nobody seems to die.
Well, people have died. People have been intimidated and disappeared, and they threaten family members. I know this. Worldwide.
But sorry, you're not. My question was.
I'm sorry.
You don't seem to be taking. Are you saying you're not able to because of corruption, you're not able to work with our law enforcement agencies, so you're not able to pass on information?
No, that's not true. I didn't mean to communicate that with you. We do. In fact, I've met with law enforcement. I have a meeting scheduled with a law enforcement agency this week. Yesterday, I met with the vice squad here in the Cape. And so I'm working with them, but I need to find people that we can trust and work with within that organization so they can get it out in an appropriate manner.
But your case of the children being shipped off in a container to Greece,
right.
Was that ever reported?
That was addressed through, yes, we took care of that. We have government officials.
Was it reported to the police? I mean, it's actually the hawks that deal with trafficking and organized crime, so I don't know if you've had any relationship with them. You speak about the vice squad, but they're not the vice squad.
And I know who the hawks are. But we've dealt with that, and we've dealt with that at a political level. We've dealt with that at a governmental level, with a law enforcement level as well. I'm trying to protect certain entities and what we do here. We may not have done it here, but we've done it in other parts of the country, other parts of the world. For example, in Greece, when that container got over there, we actually followed each child specifically and made sure each child was taken care of, because we just told the Greece officials someone would have paid them off, and eventually those children would end back up into the prostitution arena. But we physically monitor each child.
And your relationship with local NGOs on trafficking?
I've met with local NGOs. They're willing to help us. I have several of them that we've talked with.
I think Mr. Jeffrey's concerns, obviously, I mean, you're wanting us to trust you on a whole lot of stuff, but it needs to be reciprocal at a certain level. I don't know if there's anything the committee can do to assist in maybe getting to speak to more senior people in government. I don't know if we can recommend that, or if one of our colleagues, like Mr. Jeffrey, could facilitate that. And then they can then do the checking out, securities, and whatever needs to be done. But I think also you need to just clarify, as far as I understand, you are really only setting up your organization in South Africa now. So you haven't, is that correct? Can you just clarify for us? And are you intending to establish those relationships more with the NGOs?
Yes. I mean, we are just setting up operations here. I've been here many times, but I just began setting up operations up last November here. And when I've met with NGOs, I've met with other government officials, law enforcement people, and people that are boots on the ground that actually take care of the children and children themselves. But we're developing our structure here.
Mr. Hovey, I take it you've read our legislation. It's called the Prevention and Combating of Trafficking in Persons Bill. In your view, does it adequately provide for that prevention and combating of trafficking?
I have read it. I'm not versed on it, and this is not my area of expertise. I have people that are experts in that area that would provide responses to you in written form. And I think that they would have some good suggestions for you to help with that.
Are they able to put those in writing?
Yes.
Okay.
They would love to do that. I mean, they could draft up their proposal for a whole bill and probably have it done in about 5 weeks, they tell me.
No, we don't want you to draft a bill.
No.
We already have a bill.
I got that.
Okay? So we don't need another bill drafted. So what I'm saying to you is take this bill to your people, have them look through it, and then if there's anything that they would like improved in this bill, we would greatly appreciate something in writing.
Thank you.
We don't want a new bill drafted.
It's the last thing we need. I don't mean to. I want to work within your realms, and I this is an important matter to me, as I'm sure it is to you. So I'm here to work with you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. You say you've spoken to people in our law enforcement and security, and that you found them pretty weak. words to that effect.
Well, I didn't find them weak. I found weaknesses within their function. And they acknowledge, I mean, they said that themselves.
They say we don't, we just can't trust our system with what we have here. They told me that. That's not me telling them that. I'm trying to gather their information of what they see it is. And that's boots on the ground as well as upper level officials and people that have been in the system for many years, 20 years.
All right. If we were to ask you who those people are, would you be able to tell us?
I would ask them to contact you if that would be appropriate.
Doesn't quite cut it. Doesn't quite cut it. Because, you see, we have the authority in this parliament in South Africa. We'll ask you to come before us. Whether you're a policeman, vice squad, the Hawks, a national police commissioner. And if you say, I can't, then we'll make you come. So, are you not able to say to us who those people are that you spoke to?
Well, I would request
that we would ask them to talk with you, that say that there are weaknesses within your organization. I mean, these people are the ones that work in the streets. Am I missing something?
No,
Debbie? I'm trying to help.
Sure.
And I would really want, you know, if there's a weakness, I personally would want to know what that weakness is. I understand that. But I'd like these people to share openly.
All right. Prof. Ndabandaba, followed by Nkosi Holomisa.
Yeah, thanks. I just want to make a follow-up on your comment. If we were to give Mr. Hovey a copy of the bill to pass on to your experts, what time frames do you give us?
They told me 5 weeks, but I'm assuming that working within your document, they could probably have it done in 2-3 weeks in a response time, be my guess. But this is not my area of expertise.
Thank you, Chairperson. I apologize that I came late. I had to go to another meeting before coming to this one. But you've touched on what was going on in my mind when you asked us to. When you said you assumed that he has raised this bill, because I thought that was the basis of him coming here. That he has looked at the bill, now he's coming to assist us in ensuring that this bill is going to be effective in doing what it seeks to do. Now, I'm stymied now as to how then can he come and advise us on what needs to be done if he has not read this bill. How do you know if what you are proposing is not already covered here? But my question was going to be, what aspects of this bill that you believe ought to be changed in order to make this bill better than what it is, with the expertise and services that you are able to provide?
Well, if I may just add to what Nkosi Holomisa is saying is, are you then saying to this committee that your role would be purely from an operational point of view as opposed to a legislative one?
We will help however you want us to help, however we can help you. We would be glad to go through the bill we work with other countries on their bills, and we'd be glad to have our people go through the bill and make their recommendations to you. And we can get that done, I'm sure, in a short time.
You see, my difficulty is there's been a lot of work that's gone into this bill. I don't know if you probably haven't followed the process, but it started with the Law Commission, which is a sort of independent body. I mean, they produce discussion documents and then finally reports. And draft bills, and then it goes to the ministry. So this has been around for some time. The report came out in October 2008, which is a while ago, but for the Law Commission, not too bad. Or the processes that's not being unfair on the Law Commission. It's more just that sometimes things take a while to move from the Law Commission to the department, or move out of the department, rather. Let me just clarify that. But anyway, there's a lot of work that's been done.
But your response to us when we ask you about the legislation is, no, you'll speak to your people and you'll give us a bill.
A bill?
Yeah, you spoke about bringing us a bill. And that's my difficulty is that, you know, there's no cognizance of what's already been done. Mm. And we'll look at it and we'll see how we can improve it and how we can add to it. It's basically, you know.
So
that's the sort of difficulty. And I think there's a sensitivity, I must say, while I'm on the floor. Mm. You know, there's a number of there's a lot of interest in the area in South Africa, as in other countries, I'm sure. But in South Africa, there's a number of NGOs operating here, individually, as coalitions, whatever. You can't tell us who you've spoken to, who you're working with. We don't know if they've heard of you. And it's just a little bit of a problem I've got with somebody coming from outside, telling us everything is wrong and you know, don't worry about the bill you've got. Here's another one. We'll get our people to draft you a better one. Anyway, just that. So really, look. In short, what we're after is not. We've had lots of people telling us how bad the situation is, but we need empirical evidence, data, right. Not anecdotal, empirical. If it can't be done for this country, then let's at least see with the other countries. And it would be, you know, that must collect data, because the difficulty with this issue is unless that's part of corruption internationally, that the data is not collected, but we need to see that. Then I think I really would urge you to report matters to the law enforcement agencies. You've got the hawks. They deal specifically with organized crime and trafficking. Because it's only if people are arrested, people are prosecuted, that things can be done. The you've then got other agencies, as you may or may not know. You've got the Independent Complaints Directorate, which investigates complaints against the police. You've got the Public Protector. I haven't heard any complaints yet of allegations or the Public Protector has been compromised. I would urge you to take up issues with them. Thank you.
Can I, before you, Mr. Hovey, just to underscore what Mr. Jeffries told you, this may sound anecdotal, but it's fact. 30 days before the World Cup kicked off here in South Africa, this committee met, and to consider this very same bill. Because there was this concern expressed by the media, through the NGOs and everyone else, church organizations, etc., that we were going to be faced with hundreds of thousands of children, young girls, women, coming into the country as victims of trafficking. Now, we were given these figures. It was huge numbers, okay. Now, to their credit, the members of this committee thought about it and said, no, 30 days, there's just no ways that we can do justice to a piece of legislation as serious as this.
Right.
All right. We don't legislate for FIFA, because FIFA also raised red flags, like yourselves, like other NGOs. Okay. The World Cup came, it went, and then later, with the wisdom of hindsight, someone sat down and did a careful analysis of how many children and women were trafficked in. The figure was far, far below the numbers we were given 30 days before kickoff. So you see, when my members say to you, please give us your stats, your empirical data, it's for that reason. We could have been seriously burnt as a committee if we had proceeded and rushed this bill through the process, passed it, and then found, oh my God, we've got problems here, loopholes there, all kinds of anomalies. So the request for empirical data is not something, we're not just trying to catch you out or anything like that. It's for real reasons. We need to be clear about where we're going to. So please.
Before you leave, my intention is not to I respect what you've done here, and I'm coming to help, not to push what we've done or what we've got going on anywhere. However we can help you do your work, that's great. we would love to assist in that manner. And I and what you've done, you've spent a lot of work involved in this, and I appreciate that very much.
Maybe, Chair, just one more thing before I go. Do you have a website?
Yes, endangeredchildren.org.
Thanks.
Thank you very much, sir. The empirical data, we'll provide that to you with what we do have outside of the other countries with what we can. And my biggest approach here was I'd really like to try and develop a process and actually take action in obtaining that data here in this country. And I know people exaggerate the figures in some instances to garner funds for themselves. And I'm not sitting here, we don't accept money from the governments. We have people that support us outside of this. There will be things that you would need to invest in as an agency, as I speak about here, which you're doing right now. But I definitely would be willing to work with law enforcement personnel, with the NGOs within the country here as well. And we've already met with several of those groups.
Katie?
So, Chair, I think, I mean, he said that he can give us statistics, and I would like to just propose that we make an arrangement with Fonani that you can give us the statistics that you can give us as soon as possible, and that also you do give us the comments on the bill from your organization, people's experience, that, you know, that have dealt with it. Mr. Hobby wasn't brought here with a huge amount of information about, I mean, I have explained to him about the bill and so on, but it was at a very short notice, so, you know, please just bear that in mind, the context in which he's here. He's only here for a short while, so, you know, if he were to come again, I'm sure he would be better prepared, because he wasn't actually really anticipating being here. But yeah, if we could just make arrangements for comments on the actual bill that we have already done. We don't want a new one, thank you. And and also the actual statistics that you can give us if you in other parts of the world, if not here.
Yeah. Well, of course, you realize that another reason for the empirical data that we're asking for is if we, assuming that we agree that we will go to the Minister of Justice and try and persuade him, twist his arm, to give you what you want, he is going to say to us, well, okay, how big is the problem? Mm. Because based on that, he in turn has to go cap in hand to our Minister of Finance and say, I need X million rand. And the Minister of Finance will say, on what basis? Can you see?
You need to do a study, and we can help with that, develop that empirical data. That's the first thing that we actually want to achieve is that. We sort of need a mandate with you or a charter to help do that, so we can be said we'd like you to be involved in helping us gather that. We've done that in 60 other countries. We've gathered that information for them, and we're recognized within certain entities in this industry worldwide as having the data, you know, the United States, Europe, all over the place.
Right. Honorable members, anything else? No. All right, then it's my duty and pleasant task, Ms. Hovey, to say thank you to you. Thank you for taking the trouble to, at short notice. Debbie Schaefer did speak to me yesterday and said, would we be interested? And I said, yeah, okay, tomorrow. That's literally how it went. And I appreciate the fact that you were able to drop everything and find your way here. Please accept our gratitude and thanks. And anything else you need from us, please don't hesitate to ask, and we'll provide it to you.
Thank you very much. I too made a quick decision. I didn't come to Africa, South Africa on this trip. They expected to discuss with me. They expected to be underground. And we made a decision at my central operations to go ahead and
expose myself and come open to you. In a sense, that's why no suit, no tie. I just came here, and this is the best stuff I had. But we've come here to try and help. And if there's some way that we can help, which we believe there is, and I'm certain that we can help you move from a tier two to a tier one within 2 years. There's no doubt in my mind that we can do that. We have influence in that area.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Honorable members, I owe you an apology. I know that yesterday I had said we just deal with trafficking. But on reflection later in the day, I realized that, it's just over 10 o'clock now. And it's tempting to say to you, well, that's it, we're done for the day. But under the circumstances, an informal discussion with Monani, I said, well, let's carry on with harassment. And Mr. Roberts and the rest of Mr. Bassett's team agreed to stay. And we thought we would deal with harassment bill clause by clause. Now, if in the process I've messed up your own logistics, because you may not have all your documentation there, please indicate and then we'll see how we can accommodate that. I know that Mr. Jeffrey is one of those who said he didn't bring his documents, but when he comes back, I'm sure that he will. Is that okay with honorable members? JD? Okay, good. Mr. Roberts, will you lead us going through it clause by clause? And the intention is that we'll try and ascertain whether there are any further anomalies that we may have picked up. And okay, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Mr. Chairperson, I'm also going to refer to certain of the comment that was discussed in a document that was already submitted to the committee, in which certain problematic clauses was pointed out. I'm going to start now to go through the bill clause by clause. Relating to the preamble, that is on page 2 of the working document. After the words, and in order to afford a victim of harassing behavior an effective remedy.
That's this document here, honorable members. Yes. All right. Yes. Yes. Okay. Sorry, Mr. Robinson.
Comments were received to the effect that the word harassing behavior is not in accordance with what is actually expressed in the Act. We actually talks of harassment. And the suggestion was inter alia made that we delete behavior on page 2 after the words and in order to afford the victim of harassing behavior. And it was suggested that we just use the phrase harassment in that regard.
So you're proposing that the word behavior comes out?
Correct, and that harassing be substituted with harassment.
Okay. Of the working
document. Page 2, it's correct. It's at the bottom. It's paragraph A of the words and in order to. Chairperson, if we're going to work through it clause by clause, is it necessary to go through each and every definition, or can I just more or less refer to the more contentious issues in this regard?
I think what you can do is tell us where there are no changes, proposed changes, so that way members are alerted to the fact that there's nothing proposed.
As it pleases the committee. Go to page 3 of the working document. I believe it was discussed yesterday, the definitions that were inserted. Electronic communication identity number.
and Electronic Communication Service Licensing.
These are new, right?
That is new. The definition of harm stays the same. Regarding the definition of harassment, there's various proposals. The first proposal, inter alia, relates to the inclusion of sexual harassment under the definition of harassment as a first option. And then the second option makes provision for a guilty requirement in respect of harassment, and also make provisions for exemptions, or let's call it grounds of justifications. The first option starts on page 4, and the second option starts on page 5, and goes over to page 6. I believe this must be considered.
Okay. So there are two options there that we would need to exercise, assuming that there are no further options on that case. Eh?
That's correct, Chairperson. And right. Option one, if
the committee feels that sexual harassment should be included, and also give maybe effect to the option 2 and 3, it can be accommodated in a single definition, which is not currently inserted in this.
Yeah, and in option 2, I note that the question of intent is included there. Okay.
Okay, further then to proceed. I just want to refer to page 7 also, the definition of sexual harassment that was inserted as a consequence of the first option under harassment. Also want to bring it a following amendment to the committee's attention, namely that of respondent, which was amended where we inserted an additional paragraph, paragraph B, into the definition to cater for the new clauses that has been inserted in the bill into ADR to provide for electronic harassment assistance to be provided by the police, and actually the police powers. Right through the acts, we refer to a respondent as a person against whom proceedings has been instituted in terms of the act. Under that section, the is currently no proceedings instituted against the respondent, and for that purposes that definition has been inserted. Okay, that is pretty much the amendments to the definitions.
Right, let's just, honourable members, before Mr. Robertson proceeds, are there any questions for clarity thus far? Christine?
I'm sorry. I think at one of the previous meetings there was a comment by that definition of harm basically just means harm. So I see it's really, if you look at it, it means, you say harm means and a psychological sort of harm. But does it really define what harm is?
Well, strictly speaking, I think the word harm, if you take it in its ordinary meaning, it will be interpreted in that regard in the area to mean something that will adversely affect the person, if you use it in its ordinary words. So, read in conjunction with what we further define, what kinds of harm are included under the subject matter, well, I think it actually tells you exactly what it means. It means any mental condition, physical, psychological, economical action against you that adversely affects you. Well, I don't think it's necessary to define that further. No, almost if you don't define it, it goes back to its ordinary dictionary meaning.
You want to add?
Yes, Chief, I may. The reason why psychological and mental harm was included was because the aim of the legislation is to prevent physical harm where that is possible from taking place, so from a crime being committed. And that is why it was felt that it needed to be explained in that way, to be included, so that it isn't left open just to interpretation.
Prof. Ndaba Ndaba, followed by Nkosi Olumise.
Thank you, Chair. It's a question of etymology. If we look at the adjective unwelcome, now etymologically, how does one explain the concept of unwelcome? Because it's a two-way process. Seven, Chair.
Please do.
Thank you, Chair. The reason why the word unwelcome is usually used in the context of sexual harassment is because there is an expectation on the person who is the object of the attention to indicate that it is unwelcome, to make do something from their part, and that's why the word unwelcome is included in it. It's also included in the employment equity legislation, so it is almost a standard definition of sexual harassment.
Maybe just add, I think to determine unwelcome, I think again one should look at all the surrounding circumstances of the specific conduct. I believe that will be a matter for court to decide in the area. It's hard to define what is unwelcome, especially in light of this legislation. You have to have regard to various factors in this interalia, the standing of the person, the sensitivity of a person, and an array of other aspects that needs to be taken into account. I think it will be difficult to set a clear barrier where welcome and unwelcome behavior starts and ends. Sorry, where welcome behavior ends and unwelcome behavior starts.
Thanks. Just to make a small follow-up, it also includes misinterpretation. I might interpret something to be unwelcome when it is not unwelcome. So I agree with you.
So, Gushigo Prof. Zulu, Ma Umshela, Uzoti, I am full. Nangok. Because all of this.
Thank you, Chair President. Mine relates to the definition of harm, as Christy mentioned. The definition is that harm means harm of a mental, psychological, physical, or economic nature. It still doesn't tell you much to me, because I would have thought perhaps that harm should manifest itself in some kind of damage or loss. I would have thought something along those lines would go further to defining what this harm means, because just harm, you still haven't said anything. Economic nature, physical nature, psychological or mental. There must be something like a loss or some damage of a certain kind, I would have thought.
Okay, I think the big idea was when we drafted the legislation, we actually came to the conclusion that it will be very difficult in the area to provide for each and every instance of harm that can manifest itself if a person is harassed. So I believe it's the same in let's say, delictual matters, where a delict is committed against a person. Inter alia, a claim of defamation, the harm that is actually related to defamation is inter alia that inured the feelings of a person. It's very broad. I think that is how it is defined entirely in the private law. As such, we didn't.
So how do you know that there's been harm suffered if there's no loss of any kind of damage, be it psychological or otherwise?
Well, this is for the court again to decide. I believe if harm is really suffered by a person. I know the description is very, how can I call it, unsophisticated, not expansive, but it gives a clear indication that the fact that is taken into account will actually fix the court's attention to the fact that it may cause mental harm to a person. I think mental harm, it actually, inter alia, hurt your feelings. That you suffered something like psychological harm, physical harm, or economical harm. It's just more or less an indication of what the result can be from a certain harassing conduct. Again, it's for the court to decide on this, I know, but it's really difficult to go further.
Sorry, if I may, by way of an explanation, give you the example of one of the people that was harassed and brought their story to the Law Reform Commission. It was a medical doctor who treated a person, and he started receiving 300 to 400 SMSs a night. It transpired from the person was using 7 different cell phones. He was having unwelcome objects delivered to his office. He had meat delivered to his home. A great amount of meat. He had a funeral parlor arrive at his home to collect his body after he had allegedly died during his daughter's wedding. These are the kind of things that he was exposed to. So where one couldn't really quantify an economic harm as such, the effect of this on him mentally and psychologically was profound. And the effect, the stress on his home too, just the fact that he couldn't sleep, because the home phone was ringing, his cell phone was ringing, his hospital phone was ringing. This was the kind of harassment that he was being exposed to. So I'm not too sure whether we actually address that in terms of this definition, but this is what one's trying to address by including the words mental and psychological, and perhaps there's another way of doing that. But it, as I said, there isn't really a quantifiable harm to that, except that it started impacting on his work, on his family relations, it impacts on his marriage. There was, and he could bear witness to this by the phone records, by the secretary receiving some of the guests at his office and that form of thing. So in terms of the mental and psychological harm, as I said, there isn't a quantifiable harm as such. There isn't an economic link to it. But I think all of that sort of information was brought to the court in his case, who had actually ended up in a crime eventually. I don't know whether that helps.
So, what I'm making here, trying to make, is that this harm that the kind of harm we want to describe here, to define, it must manifest itself in a certain way. Maybe he's losing sleep, or he's unable to do his work properly. Because to say harm is harm. Harm means harm. It doesn't say much, because that's effectively what this definition is here. There's harm is harm of an economic nature, or physical nature, or psychological nature. And I have difficulties in this approach that the court has to decide. The laws are made for the citizens to know what they should do and what they should not do. It should not be left to the courts to decide that, oh, you did wrong. Because the same person is likely to say, oh, I didn't know that that was wrong. So the law itself must be clear to the ordinary citizen so that he doesn't have to go to court in order to understand that he was committing a crime. I'm not sure if I'm clear in what I'm trying to say here, but what I'm saying is that as I read this this part, it says harm means harm. And yet we're looking at a harm that manifests, it shows itself in a certain way. From the example they are giving, for instance, it's obvious that he has lost, for instance, maybe his sleep, or he's lost time in order to do his work because he has to attend to all of these things. So in some way there's a loss or some damage that has been inflicted upon him. So I would have thought, therefore, the definition of harm would go beyond merely saying harm is harm of a psychological nature or an economic nature.
You can actually take out the definition of harm as an example. Harm will then be unquantified to mean any harm in terms of the definition of harassment. As I have explained, harm has got a specific ordinary meaning. The definition there is more or less to try to extend the definition and to give further guidance what is included under harm. It is submitted that you don't need to go further and actually try to make or prescribe each and every type of behavior that must be brought under the definition of harm. It's the same as a murder, it's a killing of a human being. In criminal law, in the area, criminal law does not tell you each and every way how you must kill a person. The person is dead. Yeah. The same here.
No, here you're saying murder means murder. And yet, murder, the key was the word.
Yeah. All right. We'll need to decide whether it serves our purposes to improve on the definition that we have there, or whether it actually serves our purposes to remove it and be satisfied with what is contained in the definition of harassment, which is quite detailed. But we need to think about that. So, Mr. Roberts, I would ask you to just flag that definition of harm and look at how best we can improve it or remove it. Christine, did you want to? No.
I understand what you're saying, and I think my problem is around the word means. Because to me, you're trying to say it's harm includes psychological, etc. And I'm not sure in terms of whether you can say that in terms of drafting definitions. You could say harm includes, and that would cover your problem.
Well, I think you've got some leeway in definitions. It's usually something to the effect, I believe, sexual harassment or share of means. With relation to the definition of harm, we actually quantify the types of harm. Well, not quantify, we specify the specific types of harm that can be brought under the generic type of harm. I believe if you look at mental, physical, psychological, or economic harm, I don't think you can argue that the other kind of harm actually exists that actually need to be brought under this definition.
Right. Let's just put this includes the includes but not limited to.
Over to clause 2. Starts on page 7. It's application for protection order. This clause actually set out the way in which application for protection order needs to be made. Earlier provides that the complainant must, in a prescribed manner, apply for a protection order against harassment. And then clause 2 provides that if the complainant is not represented by a legal representative, the clerk of the court must inform the complainant or the other person of the relief in terms of the act, as well as also the right to lodge inter alia criminal complaint against the respondent. Something that was not considered inter alia here was the comment of the Women's Legal Center inter alia, and they actually requested that further powers be allowed to the clerks of the court to provide greater legal assistance on this matter. Well, we were opposed to that in our response to the comment. This specific clause further provides that application for a protection order may be brought behalf of a complainant by another person, and that's subclause 3A. Mm-hmm. But further, if you bring an application on behalf of another person, it must be with the written consent of the complainant, unless in certain circumstances where the court is of opinion that a complainant cannot do this. And then we make provision in subclause 4 that a child or a person on behalf of a child can apply for a protection order. And in subclause 5, we provide that this application may be brought outside ordinary court hours. In subclause 6, we provide that for the evidence that must be submitted with the application. And in subclause 7, we provide for the entity, the functionary, where the application must be lodged, namely the clerk of the court. There's no further comment that we received that. I think is necessary to be considered. Only maybe that of the Women's Legal Center, which to the effect that the word in subclause 5, namely reasonable belief, should be further defined. And the reasoning behind that is that through this definition, if it's defined, one can ensure that the clerk of the court does not refuse a protection order or urgent application for a protection order. But I think, as is pointed out in our response to this comment, that the assumption was actually wrong, and it's not the court that actually decides on the urgency of the matter, but that it is the court itself. Continue. Clause 3.
Just hold, please.
Small question on subclause 6, page 10.
Yeah.
Where it said that the interim protection order has no force and effect until it has been served on the respondent. Ooh. I take it that this has to be
way ahead of us.
I am.
Yes, we're still on page 8.
So
Okay. Oh, I'm impressed. Okay. Sorry, Mr. Robertson. Please proceed.
I continue. Okay. Consideration of the next clause deals with the consideration of application for the issuing of a protection order. Okay. The clause mainly provided clause.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. This issue on 2.4.
2.4.
What is the purpose of page 8? What is the purpose of providing for a child to be able to make? I mean, you know, we're going to have every second child coming around saying that their parents are harassing them because they're disciplining them or something like that. I mean, surely you should still have an adult, some adult. Obviously, you don't want to limit it. If people are being harassed, they should be able to go somewhere to get assistance. But to make it on their own, what was the reason behind that?
On the shelf, I believe the current Domestic Violence Act has got a similar provision, and I don't think courts were inundated with applications by children that they were actually the victims of domestic violence.
All right. I understand your concern, and I share in it. Okay.
Clause 3 deals with the consideration of application and issuing of a protection order. Clause 3.1 provides that a court must consider the application for a protection order as well as any additional evidence that is submitted to it. Subclause 2 provides that if the court found that there is prima facie evidence that harassment took place, the court must issue this protection order. Again, in subclause 3 provides that when a court issue a protection order, it must direct that be served on the respondent. And the functionaries who must serve this also further specified in the subclause, subclause 3b, this relates to the service of the protection order on the respondent, the interim protection order. Subclause 3c makes provision that respondent or that the interim protection order must call upon the respondent to show cause on the return date why the protection order should not be made final. Subclause 4 gives further effect to this application process. Entitled to notify the respondent of the case against him. Subclause 5 makes provision for the return date, the 10-day period after service has been effected on the respondent is provided for in the clause, and we also make provision for the anticipation of the court date if notice is given to the court as well as the complainant. And then in terms of clause 3.6, interim protection order will come in effect the moment it's served upon the respondent. In terms of clause 3.7, if service has been effected on the respondent, the clerk of the court must cause certified copies of the interim protection order and a warrant of arrest in terms of clause 8 that will be discussed later to be served upon the complainant.
I think she has finally come to where I was. I just wanted to know if the service of the order should be personal or can just be any other way.
Well, service of documents will usually take place in terms of inter alia that prescribed in the Magistrates' Courts Act. Unless you make specific provision for a specific way how it must be served upon the respondent. Sorry, I'm losing you. In this, we make provision that there must be a prescribed way how you must serve this order upon the respondent. That will be dealt with in subordinate legislation that will be made later on in terms of this Act. We will most probably be following suit of what is already prescribed in the in terms of the Domestic Violence Act.
Am I understanding correctly that you're asking whether the person will have to serve the notice personally? That's not what should transpire in terms of this legislation. I think under 2 sub 4, it's served on the respondent in a prescribed manner by either the clerk of the court, a sheriff, or a peace officer identified by the court. So it's not done by the person themselves. It's done through the processes of
the court. I think Nkosi Holomisa's question is, if I am the respondent, will it be served on me personally, such that I'm assigned to say I've received it? That is his question.
Pinned on the door, I see what you mean.
Yeah, that's the big issue.
If I understand correctly, you need to actually have a signature of receipt if the process in the Domestic Violence Act. I don't think it's sufficient just to pin it on the door, but I'd have to check, sorry.
As well, sorry, but I think in terms of the Domestic Violence Act, I think I have to look at it again. It is personal service. But one must always take into account the nature of the evil that we try to address here. It's earlier that there's already a person that, obscure his identity and some instances where you can actually not even get an address from him, that we might have to resort, if we draft the subordinate legislation, to the means that is the provisions of the Magistrates' Courts Act that inter alia provide for other manners of service than personal service.
Sure, it seems to be a common misconception that personal service means you have to sign for a document. Personal service doesn't mean you have to sign for a document. It means it must be delivered to you personally.
Okay.
So as long as the person can make an affidavit to say, I gave it to the person. Otherwise, everyone will refuse to sign for any order that they're supposed to give.
Yeah,
and if there is any danger of that, we need to specify that in the Act, not in any subordinate legislation.
No, I think the concern, Debbie, is that it will be pinned on my door.
No,
so you see, I mean, it could be on my office door here, on my door at Laboria Park, or at my door in my constituency office. You see, and then, you know, you may be overseas on a study tour, and, well, you're being served. That's the concern.
Mr. Chair, but at the same time, you know, there is also, we need to make sure that there is no room for that, whether that is in any legislation. I'm not aware of it ever being anywhere, that personal service you have to sign for a document.
No.
But so as long as that's not at issue, then I understand the concern on that score.
Okay.
Well, just say that I think toward the end of last year, I had a case wherein this particular woman applied for a protection order in Weinberg. And the respondent was working somewhere around there in town. I think some police officer here in Cape Town was requested to go and serve that order. So he called the gentleman to say that, you know, I've got these papers that I need to serve on you, and he wanted them to make arrangements so that, you know, he could serve those papers. So since he did not, you know, to receive that protection order, he simply just, you know, ran away, and, you know, that paper was never served on him. So in the meantime, you know, if it's personal, you know, you serve on the person, you know, personally, he has to sign and stuff like that, you know, you just run away, and, you know, the arrangement continues.
Well, it might be so, but I think, sorry, But I think if you require something like personal service and a person does not want to actually receive the process, the affidavit by earlier the person that's actually serving the document on him could be to the effect that he's actually evading service of this document, and it will be deemed that he actually that the document was served upon him.
So all I needed clarity on is whether, because it says here that the order will have no cause and effect until it has been served on the respondent. What I need is whether this means that it has to be served on the person. And serving it on the person does not mean that the respondent must actually sign.
Sure.
He can always refuse to take the order, but
forget
that's
the signature,
personal
please.
Service.
Okay.
The other service is where you just pin it on the door or leave it in the office or something like that. So that's what I wanted to know, that whether the person in the consent here would have to understand that regardless of whether the service was personal or not, it will have the force and effect, the order, because it has been served not necessarily on the person, but in some other way that is prescribed.
Shaker?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just wonder why is this inserted? I mean, normally when you get an interdict, it's immediately enforceable as soon as it's granted. Why are we making it more difficult by making this be served on the person before it's effective?
That was also some of the comment that was raised in dialogue, I believe, by the legal advice. Firstly, in this regard, there's something like an ex parte application. The respondent was never informed about this. The effect of a protection order is that the person may be arrested and they actually committed an offence. Something like an interdict. You're correct. An interdict, when it's granted, it's immediately effective against the person.
Whether they know about it or not.
Well, whether they know about it or not. But I think if a person actually does something in contradiction of an interdict. In contradiction of an interdict, and it was not served on him, I think he's actually got a valid point that it was never brought to his attention. He never knew about the court order against him. Even if an interdict is granted, I believe it must be served on the other person. I think that is, it's procedure. And if you contravene it, you also commit an offence. You actually simultaneously similar here. Our argument is that if you look at the fact that the person actually commit a criminal offence and that he can face the FT period of imprisonment of 5 years, you should actually give the person at least a notification of the fact that an order was actually issued against him. Otherwise, you might have certain constitutional issues to deal with later on.
To follow up on that, I mean, what happens if the sheriff takes 2 weeks to serve the order? I mean, then the person's not protected for 2 weeks. I mean, I understand what you're saying, but the fact it still doesn't differentiate for me that between an interdict and this, because effectively this is the same thing. This is an interdict, actually. Telling him to stop doing that. So I don't really understand the justification for the distinction between the two. And what do you do if a sheriff doesn't, the sheriff says, oh, sorry, I'm very busy at the moment and I just haven't got time. And 2-3 weeks down the line, it still hasn't been served.
Yes, sir.
Sorry, if I may. The reason behind this, too, is not only is the respondent not given the opportunity of bringing his case before the court and the order is made in his absence, but together with this interim protection order, there's a suspended warrant of arrest issued at exactly the same time. So if he's not aware of what he's not allowed to do, and he does something, that suspended warrant of arrest becomes operationalized as soon as he's done that. So I think the rationale behind this is actually to bring it to his attention, and also bring to his attention that there is a return date for him to be in court, to bring his case to court.
I can maybe just also refer to the Domestic Violence Act, which has a similar procedure in place as this. Domestic violence protection order will only have effect if it's served on the respondent. We can maybe look at it later.
I would just like to see, you know, under what circumstances interdicts like this are granted, and has there any been any challenges to it in court if it hasn't been served on the person, and how we could get around the issue of, I mean, just because the Domestic Violence Act has something similar doesn't mean it's right. It doesn't mean it works. And I know there are people who do evade service of those orders. If you can maybe just apply your mind to how we could address the issue of prompt service. If we can impose an obligation on the sheriff, I don't know if we can do that, that it has to be served within a specific time. I do understand the points, but I don't see how it differs from an interdict. You can still be had up for contempt of court if you going to comply with the interdict as well, and the same doesn't apply there. So if we could maybe get some more info on that, please.
JB?
Yeah. I don't know.
I think I'm not trying to be enforcing the
legal advisor.
The answer is not coming in. You see, in normally when you talk about service, ordinarily service, it means help. As long as it can be said that that particular process must come to the attention of the person who is being responded.
Defended and the like. You see, it's only in divorce matters where they say, for a divorce, it must be personal. Why? Because it has to do with the status of the person. The defendant must know that there is some divorce process against him or her before that status is changed to say you are now a married person or a divorced person. Now, I'm not sure insofar as the domestic violence is concerned. The domestic violence, does it require for the process to be served personally on that person, or as soon as it is served by either not necessarily attaching on a front door and the like, but even on another person who is 16 years or above or visibly occupying there. I think as it stands here, I will agree with Nkosi Kolomisa to say it's not clear whether it should be on the respondent personally, or as long as it will come to that respondent's knowledge, you see.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can refer you to clause 3.2, clause 3.3a. Sorry, it's on page 9.
Mm-hmm.
Where we provide that the manner of service of this process must be prescribed. It actually reads, upon the issuing of interim protection order, the court must direct that the interim protection order be served on the respondent in the prescribed manner. That prescribed manner relates to subordinate legislation that needs to be made, in terms of which we can determine a process. Subordinate legislation, we will actually, again, it's like legislation, you'll go out to each and everyone and ask them, what do you think, how it should be served. So the process that is prescribed in terms of the subordinate legislation will determine how it must be served, on how a document must be served. And like I said, we might follow the route of the Domestic Violence Act, or we might follow the route of the Magistrates Courts Act, which makes provision for the other ways of service which you already pointed out to the committee.
So, Chair, that's not going to allay people's concern about personal service, and I am very opposed to relying on subordinate legislation to deal with issues that we are very concerned about as a committee. I would suggest that we look at maybe just adding in the word personally, just that being reserved on responded to personally. You can then say how personally and whatever if you want, but it's quite an easy solution. At least then we know it is in the legislation, it has to be personal somehow, so that the person gets to know about it, you know, themselves.
And if you can at the same time address the concern Vanani raises, whereby I am evading it. I know it's coming, so I disappear, I go to Gauteng. What happens in that situation?
Personally might be a problem, and if you define personally somehow to include that kind of situation, I don't know if you can do that. Personally is deemed to be on an employer, but I mean that is dealt with already in the Act, so can we not get at our next meeting details of the provision in the Act, and then look whether we should rather just refer to that matter.
Domestic violence.
But in the Magistrates Court Act, it prescribes how documentation must be served. Can we just get that section?
Oh, I'm good at you, but I can tell you, Italia makes provision for, well, actually, she's the Magistrates Court expert, but it makes provision for Italia service on a person above a certain age, makes provision therefore that you can serve a place of employment, place where he resides, the attorney of a person, by registered post. So it's quite wide in terms of the Magistrates Court Act.
Okay.
I think I have to reconsider the proposal about personally.
Yeah, it's a bit difficult.
The next clause for discussion is clause 3A, which makes provision for instances where there's electronic harassment. It provides entirely, firstly, that application for protection order must be made to a magistrate.
This is new, right?
That is new, sorry. It is new. That a protection order must be made to a magistrate's court, who will consider it. And if the court is then of the opinion that protection order must be granted, but the particulars of a person is not known to the complainant, the court must then adjourn the proceedings to a certain time and date. The court must then issue a direction. The court must issue a direction to an electronic communication service provider, inter alia, to direct the electronic communication service provider to provide certain particulars of the alleged harasser to the court. This document must be served on the electronic communication service provider in terms of sub-clause 2 by a sheriff, a peace officer, or clerk of the court. We provide for a time limit in terms of which this information must be submitted to the court in terms of sub-clause 3A. We create a provision in sub-clause 3B that electronic communication service provider can, in certain circumstances, apply for extension of the period within which they must give the information to the court, as well as cancellation of the direction in certain circumstances. And this application must be considered by the court to issue the direction, and we must make a decision. And the information that is provided by the court must, in terms of clause 3-4, be submitted to the court by means of an affidavit that relates inter alia to the personal particulars of a person as well as his address. We also make provision that the other information that is provided in terms of a direction be received by the court, but that this be considered as part of the evidence that is submitted to the court in the area to determine whether there was harassment. And then we provide for a provision whereby the court must, after receipt of the necessary information, consider the application and grant a protection order. Provision is also made that the Director General of Justice, in consultation with the Director General of Communications, must compile a list of electronic communication service providers that must be made available to courts in the area to inform the courts or give them guidance and direction at which or to which electronic communication service providers a direction may be sent to obtain the relevant information. And then we make provision for costs of submitting the information by the electronic communication service providers to the court. That concludes 3A.
Right.
I'm just thinking of the discussion we had yesterday regarding anonymity and so on. I can just explain if I've got the process correct. Somebody will come to court, they don't know who the person is. The court, it will be in camera, ex parte. The court can then make an order to the police or the or service providers to get the information. Only then will the court, I mean the court will then have information that this person has been conducting certain behavior, right? So only once the order is then granted will it be, the identity will then be disclosed. And at that point then the court will already have applied the amount to all the facts of the matter, not so.
That's correct. I believe the procedure that was we followed here, you can actually follow two procedures. You get something like a preliminary application to the court in which the court must consider all the information and then grant a direction, or we can let the court already consider all the necessary facts, and then if the court came to a conclusion that there is a possibility or if there is a real possibility of harassment, and then does the court go ahead with the next step and say, okay, we think that it is necessary that this person should actually be traced, he is a real harasser, and I'm willing to grant a protection order against him if you can get his particulars to me.
So that would be the safer option in terms of trying to prevent abuses of people just trying to get disclosed identities. I mean, surely to me that's sufficient.
Well, that's this. That's what we decided.
Just not overlooking and forgetting Dr. Ambrosini's concerns about abuse. Although I do tend to think, I know that I was flippant about it yesterday, but on reflection and listening to Christine and other people about other people's experiences, it's not that easy just to say, okay, delete. Because the harm done is like enormous, it's life changing.
No.
Yeah.
Are you saying that when he was trying to make light of this, that it wasn't a serious offense?
Yes.
No, I was also
very concerned about that because it is life changing. And yes. And I know of people who have been harassed, and you can't just, even Honourable Jeffrey's comment that we should be more concerned about personal proximity. In some ways I understand where he's coming from, but I don't think that, you know, you can't say we're concerned only because of that and not aside that. It can be equally harassing and traumatic, and very often does lead to ongoing and more serious behavior following on from that.
Yeah.
And the person certainly has the feeling that that's going to happen, whether it does or not. And that in itself is traumatic.
Yeah. I know Dr. Androsini always advises that we shouldn't legislate on the basis of anecdotes, but sometimes it's unavoidable, and only when you understand what some person has gone through, the circumstances and the details, then only do you realize that, well, you know, simply deleting is, I mean, it's just hopelessly inadequate. And hopefully when he is present, Dr. Androsini, that is, I will ask some people to, without naming people, to explain some of these horrific experiences people have gone through. Yes.
While we're on anecdotes, I mean, I had another matter which was brought to my attention regarding in cyberspace, and this is the whole issue of anonymity of people on the internet. Because you don't have to actually give any identification to open an email account, this person went onto the internet, took photographs of a woman in compromising positions, an ex-girlfriend of his, put it on the internet anonymously, created a site advertising her services for sex, put her home telephone number on there, and a Google map of how to get to her property. You know, now that's the kind of thing that is happening, and it may be anecdotal, but it's true.
Yeah.
So, you know, I do agree we need to be very careful about privacy, and we do need to be careful about limiting any right whatsoever, but we've got to put adequate safeguards in place where the harm is more problematic than limitation of the right, and limited to as little extent as possible, but we do need to look at these issues.
Okay. Your mic, please, Mr. Robertson. Your mic.
Thank you, Jefferson. Page 13, the proposed clause 3B, it's also a new clause that has been inserted.
Mm-hmm.
This clause makes provision for instances other than cyber harassment where the court will grant a protection order against harassment, but the particulars of the harasser is not known. It almost contains similar wording to Section 3A regarding the procedure that needs to be followed. It makes provision, therefore, that a court must issue a direction which must be served on a station commissioner of the relevant police station, ordering the station commissioner in the area to investigate the matter with a view to ascertain the identity and address or other particulars of a person that will enable the court to identify the person. Provision is made that the station commander can get back to court and ask for extension of the period of time within which he must give this information to the court. And provision is also made that the station commissioner can get back to court inter alia to apply for the cancellation of the direction on the grounds that after a reasonable search, the identity and address of the complainant cannot be ascertained.
Yes,
sir. Sorry, just on this point and the same provision in the previous section. You're just saying that can come back to court and say they want an extension because the information cannot be provided timely. I foresee a flurry of applications from police officers coming to court saying, sorry, it can't be provided timely. I mean, sorry, but I'm cynical with good reason. I mean, we should maybe add in there with reasons or on providing good grounds why it can't be provided timely. And a good ground is not going to be, sorry, we're too busy with other matters.
Well, I don't think it's necessary, actually, to put that in, due to the fact that a person can come back to court, make an application, and the court will hear the matter, and then tell him, okay, that's not the adequate reason you've given me. Go and do your work immediately.
The section says on the ground that the information cannot be provided timely. It doesn't say anything about good reason, and I really think we need to add it.
Yeah.
But again, the person must satisfy the court in this instance. But we can look at that. A provision has been made further in subclause 4 that the court may only see the affidavit which identified an harasser, grant protection order against harassment. Okay, the next clause is clause 3C, is also a new clause that is inserted. The clause aims to give effect to the newly inserted clause 3B, which means the earlier gives the police certain powers to do certain things, to identify the name and address of a person, but it also gives the police the discretionary powers if a complainant actually approaches the police itself and the complainant actually gives indication that he or she is going to apply for a protection order against harassment, that the police may investigate harassment with the view to identify the person, obtain his address, and further particulars that by which he may be identified. Well, in terms of clause 3C2, a police officer is empowered then to request the respondent to furnish the member with his full name, address, or any other information which the member may require in order to identify and trace the respondent. This may be done in terms of either 3C1A, which relates to a request by a complainant, or in terms of clause 3C1B, where the court has, in terms of the previous discussed clause, submitted or issued a direction to the commissioner of a police station. Okay, before, in terms of clause 3C13, there are certain safeguards to ensure that the police identify itself. I just want to make a certain correction in paragraph C of subclause 3, where it reads, if a direction was issued in terms of section, then 3B1 must be deleted and it must be substituted with the following 3B1B. B.
1B.
Yeah.
Okay, bracket 1B.
Right.
Bracket 1, bracket B. Okay.
Okay, the police is fairly empowered in terms of subclause 4. If a person failed to furnish his address to the member of the South African Police Service, or if you furnish an address that police official suspect to be false, that a police official may actually arrest the person without a warrant and detain him for a period of up to 8 hours in order to verify his particulars. And then we may provision in subclause 4 or 5 that the information that is obtained by the South African Police Services must be kept by the member and must be provided to the court by means of affidavit if there is an application for a protection order. I will deal with the penal provisions later on when we deal with clause 15 relating to the subsection 3A, 3B and 3C.
Okay, but I think we need to stop and look at sub 4B there, where you want someone arrested for a period of 8 hours without a warrant. Is there provision in law for that already? Is there precedent? Is it okay?
Yes.
Are we going to be challenged?
Well, I can refer you to Section 41 of the Criminal Procedure Act. I've made a copy of that. And I'm going to refer you to Section 2 of Section 41, which reads, any person who, when called upon under the supervision of Subsection 1, which actually empowers the police to obtain certain particulars of a person who has not yet committed an offence, but where there is a reasonable suspicion that he may commit an offence or may be involved in an offence, that the police official may, in terms of that clause, arrest the person. I'm going to read the whole clause. It's probably better. Section 41(1) of the Criminal Procedure Act reads as follows. The police officer may call upon any person whom he has power to arrest, who is reasonable, suspected of having to commit or of having attempted to commit an offence, or with an opinion of the peace officer may be able to give evidence in regard to the commission or suspected commission of offence, to furnish such peace officer with his full names and address. And if such person fails to furnish his full name and address, the peace officer may forward and without warrant arrest him. Or if such person furnishes to the peace officer a name or address which the peace officer reasonably suspects to be false, the peace officer may arrest him without warrant and detain him for a period not exceeding 12 hours until such name or address has been verified. So it's already in the Criminal Procedure Act, Clause 41, and it has not been constitutionally challenged up till now. We just follow suit with this provision and actually take it over and put it in the Protection of Harassment Law.
Okay. And I take it that your reference to other information in this clause we're busy with now could be things like his ID document or a copy thereof.
That is correct.
The other information relates to means to identify the person.
Okay.
It sometimes actually happens that the person may not have an address or a home or something else, but he could probably be identified through other means.
Okay. All right. Honourable members?
It's only after an affidavit in terms of one has been given, right? So if only once an affidavit has been given is that there are grounds for harassment, then they refuse to give the information.
The Honourable Shobis Tole.
Thank you, Chair. Sorry for coming late. I had to go to intelligence first. I'm just worried at the back of my mind that if a person is suspected by the police and arrested, maybe at the point of arresting that person, there is some drama which actually humiliates the person. And it is found that this is not the right person. Where is the protection of the human dignity of that individual?
I believe the remedy for that is actually in the civil law. The person can institute a civil claim against the South African police, and I believe it happens frequently.
Yeah, it's good if we raise these concerns now during this period and during the consideration of this bill, because at all times we're faced with these dilemmas, you know. On the one hand, ensuring that this person's harassment is brought to a quick end, and on the other, also ensuring that, well, the wrong person is not addressed or arrested and should, yeah.
You know, I come from the rural area.
I come from the rural area, and I'm just imagining, you know, an ordinary Shangan woman who doesn't even know English. She doesn't even know that she can claim against the police. She would only be too frightened to do that. How does the law protect that type of person who would be scared to claim against the police?
Well, I believe the only other protection, like I've indicated, is through civil remedies. There is no other protection available. If it's unlawful, you can actually go to inter alia, the independence complaints directive, and complain against them, against the police, and they can investigate the matter further. There is certain other structures that, to an extent, can investigate certain overreaches by police. I believe the public protector also got certain powers in that regard, but I don't think other than that there is any other structure or provision that regulates this. I believe in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act, there is a certain provision that actually makes it an offence for police to act in a certain way, which is punishable by inter alia imprisonment and a fine. That can also be considered if necessary.
Mr. Bassett.
Thank you, Chair. I wanted to also mention what Mr. Roberts has just referred to, the, and we could possibly get it, I could get it on the laptop, early on in the Criminal Procedure Act, where the police do overreach or do things that they're not by law entitled to do, and one could possibly have a look at that provision to see if we can't bring it in here if the committee feels has a concern about it. I think in that particular case it's where a person, where a policeman has to use force to enter premises. I don't know whether it's going to work ideally in a situation like this, but also, and Sorrel said that we'd have a look at the penal provisions. There are the penal provisions later on in this law in terms of which a police official can be hauled over the coals and subject to criminal sanction if he or she does what they shouldn't be doing. So we could also try and, if the committee is prepared to contemplate a provision of this nature, to try and build that in there as well, so that a police official that does overreach is brought to book.
All right. Just also bear in mind, I think Mr. Ambrosini made the point yesterday, and what will you do if you come to me as the member of the South African police and I exercise my right just to remain silent? I don't even respond to you. And then you arrest me. Well, there's nothing much, I suppose you'll just be, I'll just be arrested. Phew. Right, first the Honourable Shopistole, followed by the Honourable Schaefer.
Yeah, I think the department has a lot of responsibility to actually give information to ordinary South Africans, because many a times you see that behavior. You know, when I'm at home, I like to dress up in my Shangan clothes. I don't wear Western clothes when I'm at home. And I was in my house. I've got some rooms where I rent out to people, and one of the occupants of one of the rooms had some problems with somebody else. Now I was standing there, they didn't know it's my house and they don't know me. So they came in, it was the police a woman police with this person. Then when they came there, they just shouted at that man, "Hey, when I come here, jan. Then I was surprised, this type of behavior. Then they were calling that person. I just said, "Sissy, come here." He said, "No, Mama, you mustn't waste my time. I'm a police, and I am in a hurry. You know, this woman is really jan. So I said, "No, Mama, Sissy, just come here." Then I said, "Why do you behave like this? Because you should have greeted me. It's my home here. Why do you enter my house like that?" "Then, no. I said, no. You don't even have the right to shout at that woman the way you have done. Why don't you talk to her nicely?" So I'm saying something that I have seen happening. It's only after I have told her that if you do this next time, I'm going to report you to the minister because I'm a member of parliament. Now every day she greets me and she has
All right, let's look at that, please, Mr. Roberts, and see what is in the CPA may serve our purposes. I think constantly as we go through this bill, we'll be faced with these dilemmas, which we're going to have to eventually, as a committee, decide. They don't decide, we decide. They can only point us in the direction of which we should possibly take, but the ultimate decision remains ours.
Chair, just what's on the penal provisions? A person that does give false information when requested by the is also going to be guilty of an offence, so can bear that in mind as well.
Sure. Ma'am?
Chairperson, you also see that a number of these things that we are discussing or hearing are procedural issues and things that really come down to practical policing, and that's why on page 28 you'll see that there are provision made for policy directives, and
yeah,
this mirrors what is done in the Domestic Violence Act, where if a person doesn't comply with national instructions issued by the police, then they will be found guilty of misconduct, and the normal processes within the police will then take place, but one can't necessarily prescribe for all of those eventualities in terms of the legislation.
Yeah, well, we'll deal with that when we get there, because, you know, I don't know how honourable members feel about this. I've heard Ms. Schaefer speak about, what is the term we use? What legislation?
Subordinates,
yeah. Because, yeah, they speak about them being published and tabled in Parliament, but that's as far as it goes. We need to look at that at the time. But please proceed, Mr. Roberts.
Yes, Chairperson. Next clause starts on page 16 of the working document. It relates to the attendance of witnesses. The first sub-clause make provision that the court may, at any stage of the proceedings, subpoena a person to be to attend proceedings. And the second clause makes provision that a witness who is not perceived as a subpoenaed but who is present at the proceedings may be warned to attend further proceedings in terms of the bill. Sub-clause 3 was amended. That indicated we'd like to include both sub-clause 1 and 2 under the criminalising provision, so that if a person who was either warned or subpoenaed and who fails to attend any proceedings or remain present at such proceedings or to any place where it, to which it has been adjourned to, will be guilty of an offence.
We've reached clause 4. I'm informed that tea is served. Do members want to have an actual break? It's not served.
Oh, no.
Took it away.
They broke up the
All right, let's carry on. Bonani will sort it out. No. I'm glad for your intervention because I would have been embarrassed. Sorry, Mr. Roberts, please proceed. Yeah. Okay.
That provides for circumstances in which proceedings may not take place in open court, and also the prohibition of certain information. It provides that the court may, firstly, at the request of the complainant or a related person, also if it is in the interest of the administration of justice, that proceedings should be held behind closed doors, direct, firstly, that the public or any class thereof may not be present at those proceedings, or that the identity or address of a person may not be revealed, or that no information relating to the proceedings be published in any manner whatsoever. Also, the subclause 2 provides that where a witness in proceedings under this Act is a child, the court may direct that no person other than the child, obviously, and certain persons relating to the child may be present at that proceedings. Okay, and then there's a general exclusionary provision that was included in the form of subclause 3. We actually give the court wide discretion to hold proceedings in camera. Subclause 4 is a new clause that was inserted as a result of the representations that we received from AGUSA.
Mm-hmm.
And that is to the effect that we afford certain persons present at the proceedings the opportunity to apply to court, firstly to be present at the proceedings, or further to publish certain information relating to the proceedings. Clause finish.
Any questions at this point, honourable members? If not, I do believe that, well, I see an urn there. I hope it's not just hot water. All right, let's. Can we break for 15 minutes? All right, and then we'll reconvene, Mr. Robertson, please. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, I suppose the question is, who does the trumpet? Yeah. Honourable members, with your permission, I think so that we all know where we are, we will stop at 12:30. Mr. Bassett, Mr. Robertson, and your team, ma'am. All right. So that all of us can, some of us can go and have lunch. And Mr. Bassett, your team, and then I suppose we'll make arrangements to leave. Yeah. Bonani, we are meeting with the NPA tomorrow, eh? And they have a document which you will distribute. Good. So that ahead of tomorrow's meeting with the NPA, honourable members, you will have read just what they have to say, and then they can just speak to their document, and then we'll take it from there. That is dealing with trafficking. And I assume a few other matters as well. So, Mr. Robertson, let's...
We'll proceed now. Page 18, clause 6,
relates to the issuing of a protection order, makes provision for two scenarios. The first one is where the respondent does not appear on the return date, if the court is satisfied that the interim order has been served on him, the court may then issue a protection order without further ado. The second scenario, subclause 2, provides for a return date where the respondent actually appears and kind of opposes the issuing of a protection order. A hearing will then take place, and the court will then consider all the evidence during that proceedings to see if a protection order may be issued. During consideration or during this procedure, the hearing, provision is made in the area to kind of protect certain people against secondary victimization, especially when the respondent is not represented by a legal representative. The provision, subclause 3, provides that certain questions that is then posed to a witness and a complainant must be posed to the court, and the court must then repeat it to the witness and or the complainant. Subclause 4 make provision for the approval or issuing of a protection order, and after hearing, if a court then finds on a balance of probabilities that harassment has taken place, the must grant a protection order against harassment. When this in terms of subclause 5, when the final protection order is issued by a court, the regional order must be served on the respondent, and a certified copy of that order and an original warrant of arrest must be served on the complainant. And the function is that must serve these documents as the clerk of the court, sheriff, or a peace officer that is identified by the court. Okay, the clerk of the court has the responsibility to immediately forward copies of any protection order and of the warrant of arrest to a police station of the complainant's choice. Subclause 7 is not a new clause, but has been amended as a result of representations that we received from the South African Police Services. And in terms of the newly proposed clause, we propose that a period of validity be imposed on a protection order, and we propose a 5-year period. Obviously, in the interim, and I will discuss later in other provisions, it can be set aside before the expiration of that period.
Jefferson, relating to three,
yes,
where the respondent is prohibited from cross-examining the complainant, is that such a provision in any other law?
The Domestic Violence Act has got a similar provision.
Yeah. And then in rape cases, which I would imagine could be even more serious than sexual harassment or harassment, does that apply, that principle apply?
I don't think it directly applied to criminal proceedings, but there are certain other procedures are in place in the area to protect the complainant in criminal proceedings, in the area that the proceedings usually in sexual matters might only take place in a close court. I believe there's also provision that in certain instances
the complainant may give evidence through integrated camera in certain courts.
Yeah, I was quite nice when I saw that, but I think we need to make sure we read the next section too. It's not that you can't cross-examine, it's just that it has to be done through the court.
To the presiding officer, as opposed to directly to him or her. Well, I don't know how that works, but... Nkosi Olomisa?
It doesn't that defeat the purpose of the right to cross-examine a witness? Or are we lowering standards or change varying them because of the nature of the situation?
Well, I don't think it lowers, affects the right to cross-examination. Like I said, it gets rid of the secondary victimization of a person that is already harassed and now has to face her arrest again in court. And she might be frightened by this person, sometimes even so frightened that she cannot continue with the proceedings if he confronts her directly.
Chairperson, this is a triad. If I may interrupt you a little bit, I thought this is a triad which is aimed at establishing the truth. And one of the ways of establishing the truth is to cross-examine the witness, either by yourself or by your lawyer.
This is actually civil proceedings per se, not like criminal proceedings where your liberty are at risk. But I can probably take it a bit further. In the case of intermediaries, evidence is given over a closed circuit television, and sometimes and there's intermediary present, mostly in the case of children. And the children in sexual matters in the area give evidence through the intermediary, and any cross-examination is also then relayed via the court, the intermediary, to the child witness. And I believe that procedure has not been found to be unconstitutional. I think it was constitutionally challenged once, the intermediary process, and it was found to be constitutional. As such, I don't think this will have any negative impact on the process, and it will not have actually have impact on constitutional rights of a person. He's being cross-examined.
I think it's discretionary. The presiding officer is in a position to determine whether this can be done or not.
Chair, I think this was, as Cyril has said, it's also in the Domestic Violence Act, which is also civil, really civil-based. But what I can do, and I think we owe it to you, is to get the reports of the Law Commission for Domestic Violence where this was dealt with. And I think it was also dealt with perhaps not as extensively as in the domestic violence report, so that you have the benefits. We'll identify the arguments to and against, for and against, and we'll make that available. I think that could most probably set it out quite nicely, and the Law Commission in the course of its evaluation of what they propose, they're also they're very careful and they look at constitutionality, and I'd like to think that those were also dealt with. I don't have all those answers at my fingertips, but I would just like to set your mind at ease and the committee's mind at ease that when those were first considered.
Can we also can you also just check if it was in fact a constitutional court challenge, and if so, can we have that judgment? I think we need to just. I don't know why you say the person's liberty is not at stake, because it is at stake. If they don't comply, they're going to get arrested. But I do think we need to distinguish between the rape. I think it would be nice if it applied to rape, but that's dealt with under the Criminal Procedure Act. We're busy making new laws now, and that's why we're putting it in here.
Chair, could we obtain clarity as to whether or not the provisions of the Child Justice Act have been considered in this procedure?
Chair, in what context, if I may just get clarity on the Child Justice
and then the procedure, the way that the child is being handled in court.
Sorry, the Child Justice Act relates to criminal proceedings, not civil proceedings.
Right. Let's move on.
Clause 7.
Sorry, before we proceed to Clause 7.
Yes.
Chapter 7. That is session for a period of 5 years.
Mm.
Why is it necessary? Why can't that be left to the discretion of the court as to for how long that protection order should be enforced?
Well, I've indicated yesterday that... I think the big problem is the police has got a big administrative burden. They need to do the Domestic Violence Act. They need to keep certain registers regarding the RICA things that is reported to them. And there's a lot of things like this. I think that if we place a 5-year term of validity on a protection order, it should be sufficient in the area to protect the complainant. After that, we can probably look at it, or to extend it, maybe, time period, or make provision that the applicant or complainant does not need to reapply, but probably maybe insert a process where she can file affidavits to the court to the effect that it may need to be extended for a certain period of time. That is the one alternative to try to accommodate the police. The alternative would be that the complainant would have to approach the court again and apply for another protection order.
Are you contemplating us amending this to read or for a lesser period determined by the court?
Yes, I thought it could be that they make peace among themselves and then the person decides maybe the complainant to... Well, it does say unless it is set aside.
Is that what it means?
For a period of 5 years. Does that mean then the complainant could go and say, no, let's set this aside?
Yeah, we've kissed and made up.
There is a provision that provides for this later on in the bill.
Where, Mr. Robertson?
That will be discussed later on.
No, I know it will be discussed later, but just...
Let me just get to it. It's close to 10.
10?
Starts on page 23.
Yes, and
relation is setting aside a protection order. And then it sets out that the complainant or respondent may put notice to the other party and the court concerned apply for the variation or setting aside of the protection order.
All right, that's under sub 2, eh?
That's correct.
Okay, fine. Because the Olamisa, does that satisfy? It satisfies me, I don't know if it satisfies me. Okay,
move on to the next provision. It's on page 19 still. It's clause 7. It relates to the court's powers in respect of a protection order. In terms of subclause 1, the court may, by means of a protection order, prohibit the respondent from engaging in certain types of harassment, either himself through another, or also committing any other acts specified in the protection order, which may go wider than actual harassment. Subclause 2, provides also that the court may impose any additional conditions which it may deem reasonable, necessary to protect and provide for the safety or well-being of the complainant or related person. Mr. Chairperson, I think the department wants to propose an amendment to
subclause 2. The effect of subclause 2 is that the police is actually also included under the subsection. And the court may order a police officer in Zaire to seize certain firearms, to accompany a person to a specific place, and also to give a direction to a station commissioner to investigate a matter for the possible institution of criminal provisions. As you may recall, in terms of section 15.1 of the bill, which is on page 25, it will be an offence for any person inter alia to contravene an order. So a police official will actually commit a serious offence for which he can be imprisoned. He can be imprisoned for a period up to 5 years if he does not give effect to order of the court. Between ourselves, we discussed it yesterday, and it is our submission that if a police official actually fail in the exercise of his duties in terms of this clause, that it should rather amount to misconduct and not the serious offence that is being created in terms of clause 15.1. That is the first proposed amendment.
Well, it's just their opinion.
I want to know why.
Oh, okay.
Well, let's say there's various functionaries in the civil service and elsewhere on which certain duties are imposed, but I haven't come across, except maybe the Public Finance Management Act, in terms of which serious penalties may be imposed on a person for not doing his duty.
Yes?
Public Finance Management Act doesn't have power to arrest people and put them in prison in police cells and be subjected to all those kind of things. And yeah, we can look at that, but I mean, the police particularly have a huge capacity to abuse their powers. That public finance people also do, but the physical effects are not necessarily as serious.
Through the chair, if I may, in the development of the Domestic Violence Act, there were proposals initially to have the police officers criminalised for non-compliance of a number of provisions in the Domestic Violence Act at that stage. The debate that went around that eventually culminated in the inclusion of the policy directives in which national instructions would be issued by the police, in terms of which if the police don't comply with certain provisions, there would be disciplinary steps, it could be misconduct, and they could be fired from their jobs, depending on what the circumstances were. And the rationale around that is that if you are going to criminalize police or make a criminal sanction of this nature attached to these clauses, you're going to have very few police officers that are going to want to be involved in any one of these cases. So that is just a practical measures. But there really is a history behind this relates to what happened with the Domestic Violence Act. And unfortunately, this slipped in as an offence, and it should have actually been included in the national instructions. So it really was an oversight on our part there.
Yes.
So you're telling me that police aren't going to want to be involved in this if we criminalise them doing something wrong, which implies that you're saying that the police are doing something wrong when they're investigating these matters. This only criminalises them if they do something wrong. So on what basis would they not want to be involved in them?
If I may reply, if one looks at the what they are expected to do in terms of process, if we're looking at accompanying a person to collect personal property, for example, there are a lot of challenges. When the tacky hits the tar, and one's actually in that situation, police are faced with a number of choices to be made, whether they should arrest or not arrest a person for non-compliance of a protection order, and in this case, whether they should assist a person to remove certain goods or not, and what is personal and what's not. There's a number of issues and choices that need to be made.
and as complicated as it is, and if they were to overstep the mark, perhaps negligently, perhaps not in compliance with the legislation, but not intentionally, they may face a very serious criminal charge against them.
The effect of this specific section you are wanting to take away the criminal penalty.
Chairman, I just say we should have had this discussion, and I think we need a bit of internal discussion on this issue as well, and come back to you on that particular proposal.
All right. I think I hear what you're saying, and I can't find fault with it. It's just that from the Honourable Schaefer's point of view, I mean, our own experience with the police is that they really don't like these things. The minute you speak about harassment, domestic violence, they don't want to be involved. But in the process, somebody may be dying or experiencing serious harm, and that's the concern she's trying to raise. I don't have a solution for you, unfortunately.
No, it's the whole thing.
Oh, probably a less serious penal clause. A further amendment that is proposed to the current clause 7.2 relates to the personal property, which was dealt with yesterday, and we provide that it should be personal property that has been identified in the application for a protection order that need to be collected if a police official accompanies a complainant for that purpose. Okay, then further in terms of clause 7, on page 20, it's sub-clause 3. Provision is made that certain particulars of the complainant must be omitted from the protection order. On this, there's obvious need that it should be included in the protection order. And also, the court is given wide discretionary powers to ensure that a complainant or related person's physical well-being is ensured in the area that certain particulars must also not be made available related to that person's. The current subclause 4 provides that a complainant was not in possession or in the process for applying for harassment, protection order against harassment and stalking as provided in the Domestic Violence Act, that the court may not refuse to issue a protection order or to impose any condition or make any other order which it is competent to impose or to make under this section merely on the grounds that other legal remedies are available to the complainant. And also a provision is made that the court may also order that certain provisions in terms of other laws that might be relevant may stay in place for a certain period to entirely allow the complainant to find the appropriate remedy for a problem. Sorry, I can probably just expand maybe on the provision subclause 4 that relates to the Domestic Violence Act. I believe certain of the persons that actually gave comments on this provision has questioned subclause 4. Which relate to the Domestic Violence Act, and the reason is that the argument is that if a person seeks some relief in terms of the Domestic Violence Act, and there is a certain procedural mess up or the process
the process actually prohibits the issuing of the relevant protection order in terms of the Domestic Violence Act, that she be afforded full opportunity to actually just go ahead and use this act to seek the same kind of remedy that could have been given in terms of the Domestic Violence Act, and that we should not prohibit through this clause, subclause 4. That was one of the major concerns that was raised. I think it was raised in Tidy by Witz.
And essentially what we're saying in 4 is that you can't have two bites of the cherry.
That's correct.
Hmm. All right, we'll have to think about that, honorable members. I'm loath to just say yes, it's fine, because there may be circumstances whereby the complainant may want to can she opt out? Or just think about it.
Next clause deal with the warrant of arrest upon issuing of a protection order. When a court issues a protection order, which includes an interim protection order, in terms of clause 3, the court must also authorize a warrant of arrest for the arrest of the respondent. This warrant of arrest is usually suspended pending non-compliance with the order, prohibition, or condition obligation that is imposed in terms of the protection order. In subclause 2, we propose a small amendment there too. The warrant referred in subsection 1A remains in force unless the protection order, if the committee then opts for the 5-year shelf life clause, we like to insert there also the phrase expires in terms of section 6-7. And then further on, it stays the same. After order, protection order expires. So it will be expires in terms of section 6-7, set aside, or cancelled after execution. If this warrant is lost, further warrant of arrest may be issued to the complainant. She must actually file an affidavit to that effect. The real protection is also what is prescribed in terms of this clause, namely that if a complainant, the respondent, actually do something contrary to the protection order, the complainant may hand this warrant of arrest together with the affidavit in the prescribed form, where she states the manner in which the complaint the respondent actually contravened the protection order to a member of the South African police. The member of the South African police may then, if there's reasonable grounds that the complainant may suffer imminent harm as a result of the alleged breach, that's on page 22, clause B, he may arrest the respondent for an offence that has been that is created. The offence is mainly that he contravened a protection order. Alternative provision to cater for certain circumstances is provided for in subclause C, where he made provision that the South African police may actually give something similar to a written notice to a respondent in appropriate circumstances. So, in terms of which you have to appear in court. This is to provide for certain circumstances where the alleged harassment is not of such a nature that it actually warrants the arrest of the respondent. Okay, in terms of clause 5, it was actually, clause 5 was inserted as a result of a comment that we received. It's IA from the Women's Legal Center. We inserted certain, let's call it factors, that the police must consider in order to determine whether the complainant is suffering imminent harm, and that to determine whether to arrest the respondent or not by the South African Police Services. Okay, then provision is also made in clause 8 that when a warrant of arrest is handed to a member of the South African Police Services where there was alleged breach of the protection order, the South African Police Services must also inform the complainant of a right to lay a criminal charge and also explain to the complainant the manner in which she can lay a criminal charge.
Chair, a comment Ms. Schaefer made earlier that the civil liberties of the respondent are not at stake here. And yet we keep talking about a warrant of arrest.
Civil liberties. Actually, due to the fact that there is already a warrant of arrest authorized for the person, is that what you mean, Mr. Olamiza? Or can this?
In relation to the entire matter, at some stage, he's likely to go to jail.
Okay, during the previous, when we discussed that, that related mainly to the consideration of the issuing of a protection order. During that stage, he's not on trial for an offence for which you can actually commit him and send him to prison. That trial is in relation to whether a protection order should be issued or not issued. Okay, that is distinct from the warrant. The warrant is only comes into being if the court actually decides to grant a protection order. A warrant is then issued simultaneously. And that is the instrument that will actually put the respondent in jail if he contravenes a protection order. But then it's later on and it's completely in his hands.
He's likely to end up in jail at some stage because of the entire exercise.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, he missed out because he couldn't directly cross-examine the complainant. And then he ends up without without getting the desired effect, which is of cross-examining a person, a witness. Then a protection order is granted against him, and thereafter he violates it for some reason or other, he ends up in jail. Eventually, he will end up in jail.
Mr. Lamiza, yes, so that if there is something like a procedural irregularity or certain other factors that might render the original consideration for the protection order not in accordance with let's call it general legal principles, or render that trial unfair, he's got a right during the... he has the right to take that procedure on appeal or review. Provision is made in terms of the bill that such proceedings can be taken on appeal or review if he thinks that his rights has been adversely affected by the trial.
Yeah.
No, it's not that I was mistaken this time, it's that I was just sure. alerting us.
Really. Yeah.
I think it's a misconception that the person is not allowed to cross-examine. They are allowed to cross-examine. They're just not allowed to do it properly to that person. So they can ask all the questions they want to ask, but it just must be repeated by the presiding officer. And I would assume that would be in the presence of both parties, so they can see that the question is being repeated accurately. So there's not an issue about not being able to cross-examine.
Well, there's a good thing that there's a reason why a person has a right to cross-examine the person accused of it. Now, you're reducing your right now, the right of the person, by directing him or her to cross-examine to somebody else, even if that somebody else is the presiding officer. But I did say that it says there's a discretion on the part of the
On the court.
But this is a child, for instance, who's clearly vulnerable. Then the presiding officer could protect the child.
And, would it be any different if the respondent was represented in court? Because then the respondent wouldn't be posing the question, but his or her legal representative would do it. I'm just wondering whether that isn't almost the same as via the presiding officer. Might be more brutal. Okay. All right, Mr. Robert, sir.
The discourse on the page 25 on the seizure of damaged weapons.
Your mic, please, Mr. Robert, sir.
Sorry, Mr. Chairperson. Page 23, clause 9 provides for the seizure of arms and dangerous weapons. The court, in terms of this clause, the court may order a member of the South African Police Services to seize any arm, which means a firearm or a dangerous weapon, in possession or under control of the respondent. And then after it has been seized, the court may refer a copy of the record of the evidence to the National Commission of South African Police for consideration in terms of the Firearms Control Act. Investigation relates to the competency of a person to possess a firearm.
I'm going to be naughty. So you've taken away, you've disarmed him. Very good. And the complainant's weapons and arms?
That is probably in the house. You can use that.
I'm being naughty, but, you know, very naughty. So she must be allowed to keep her arms. Eh? Okay. Oh, she can't shoot him? Okay. All right. Okay. Fine. Okay. All right. If I were her, I would shoot him. Your mic, please, Mr. Robert.
Okay. Subclause 1 make provision that protection order can be varied or set aside and it can only be done if the court is satisfied that the circumstances has materially changed. And provision is further made that the clerk of the court must forward a notice as prescribed to the complainant and respondent if the protection order is varied or set aside. Continue with the next clause. Makes provision for jurisdiction. Grounds for jurisdiction is set out in subclause 1 in relation to the complainant and the respondent, and also it indicates that the place where the course of action arose will the court will have jurisdiction in terms of that to issue a protection order. We proposed an amendment yesterday to subclause 2 and I'd like to also insert to the end of Satluks 2 by all B. It was explained yesterday, and we in terms of Satluks 3, the protection order is deemed to be enforceable throughout the Republic. I think there's problems there. Service of documents, right through the bill, provision is made that certain functionaries must serve certain documents. This is just to give effect to the obligations imposed on that functionaries. Clause 13 provides for costs. It's quite an important clause, this. And it states that a court may only make an order as to cost against any party if it's satisfied that a party in question has acted frivolously, vexatiously, or unreasonably. Furthermore, clause 14 relates to appeal and review, and the provisions relating to appeal and review are set out in the Magistrates Courts Act and the Supreme Court Act is applicable to the provisions of the bill. Of some importance is the offences, clause 15.1a currently states that if any order that's contravened by a court, if an order imposed by a court is contravened, the person commits an offence, and that may mostly relate to protection orders. If a person breached that, he will commit this offence. In alternative, we also made provision, therefore, that if a complainant wants to enforce the warrant of arrest, and that the protection order has in fact been let's say broken by the complainant, mm-hmm. She must actually then make an affidavit, and if you make a false affidavit, it will be deemed to be an offence in terms of clause B, and the same period of imprisonment that can be imposed for contravention of a protection order can also be imposed for a false statement in respect of a contravention of a protection order. Clause 2 mainly deal with the revealing of certain particulars of the complainant. It is criminalized. If a person reveals that information contra to a court decision, of more importance is probably the certain offences that is created in terms of electronic communication service providers. That mainly relates to the information that must be furnished to the court. If if an electronic communication service provider make a false statement or does not provide the information within the specified time period, they commit certain offences. Offences has been created in respect of both electronic communication service providers as well as employees of electronic communication service providers. Certain offences also created in respect of the South African Police Service mainly relates to false statements that can be made in terms of certain affidavits that must be submitted to the court, and we deemed it necessary that a period of imprisonment not exceeding 6 months or a fine imposed in such circumstances. And then to give bite to section, the proposed clause 3C2, 3C being the clause that gives the police certain powers in order to obtain particulars from the person. They made it an offence that if a person fails or furnish a false address to a police officer, that he or she is committing an offence. And we proposed a fine or imprisonment not exceeding 6 months for that kind of contravention.
Honourable members, we'd need to, I'm tempted to ask Mr. Roberts what informs you that the electronic communication service licensee must be fined 10,000 rand. But as a committee, we would need to decide whether this is appropriate or inadequate. They earn tens of millions of rands, and I know that in Rica, they stand to lose their license if they don't comply. But that it's something I'll put to the committee at the appropriate time. So just please flag it and bear it in mind. Okay, Mr. Roberts. Your mic, please. Sorry.
Clause 16 make provision that the minister may make certain regulations to further regulate aspects in terms of this act. This mainly relates to certain procedural aspects that need to be further regulated. We provide that any regulations so made must be submitted to Parliament, and also if it results in state expenditure, it must be made in consultation with the Minister of Finance. And we also create a penal clause, or not actually a penal clause, but we provide that if subordinate legislation is made, that offences can be created, and that a fine or imprisonment for a period of not exceeding 1 year may be imposed for such contraventions. Okay. Clause 17 relates to policy directives. It mainly imposes a duty on the National Director of Public Prosecutions, the National Commission of the South African Police Services, and the Director General of Justice and Constitutional Development to issue certain policy directives to inter-area further regulate aspects under this Act with which the members must comply. Well, that is the main reason for that, and we provide on page 29, subclause 4, that the directives and instructions referred to in this section must provide that adequate disciplinary steps must be taken against the person who fails to comply with any directive or instructions, as the case may be. Currently, subclause 4 references made to a prosecutor or police official. The clerk of the court has not been inserted.
I'm sorry, Mr.
It's on page 29.
Yes.
Sub 4,
yes,
of the last sentence, or the second last one, where it states adequate disciplinary steps will be taken against the prosecutor or police officer. No provision is made for clerks of the court.
You want that put in? Okay.
I think it's already there.
Yeah, all right. Look. Clerk of the court. Okay.
Okay, then the next clause deals with certain laws that is amended in the field. And this bill, once passed, will be put into operation by means of a proclamation due to the fact that subordinate legislation must be made first. The amendments to the bill set out in the schedule. First amendment on page 30, runs over to 31, relates to the old Criminal Procedure Act, the so-called peace orders. That has been amended to make it more effective. not going to go through each and every clause that we want to insert there. These are items that can be read. On page 31, amendment to the Criminal Procedure Act, that relates to certain bail conditions, or rather what must be considered in a bail application, and we have inserted in the Criminal Procedure Act that the view of any person against whom an offence was allegedly committed regarding his or her safety must also be considered during such a bail application. I think that was the 19. And the next amendment relates to the Domestic Violence Act, where we also inserted the provision that makes provision for the subpoenaing of witnesses in such proceedings into the Domestic Violence Act.
Mm-hmm.
The Firearms Control Act is adapted to its idea provide for this act, but it's a consequential amendment. And that is pretty much it.
All right. Honourable members, just please also flag the fact that when these directives and the regulations, presently the bill says submit to Parliament. Now, we may need to take that a little further, whereby we actually approve and possibly amend. So that applies to both regulations and these proposed directives. Okay, so just please flag that for when we deal with it at the appropriate time. Mr. Bassett.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to remind members that these amendments in the schedule, the back of the bill, some of them are consequential in nature and others are. The intention was to improve the functioning of, for instance, the Section 384, the Old Criminal Procedure Act and the Domestic Violence Act, and I do recall that there were some members that queried the wisdom of improving other acts rather than just dealing with consequential amendments. It would be useful. I don't know how the committee feels about that. At this stage, if we flag that as well.
Let's flag that as well. Okay. Okay. All right. We had a nice long morning. So let's thank Mr. Bassett, Mr. Robertson in his absence, and you, man, for taking us through the bill. We'll stop here now. Go away and think about it. Minister Praveen Gordhan will assist us in that exercise. And as I said, tomorrow morning, just for your information, the technical committee comprising Mrs. Jeffrey, Dean Smuts, and Ambrosini will meet in the morning. Members are free and entitled to attend those deliberations should you wish to. You're not being forced to. And those will go on until 12. After lunch, we will. After lunch. 12 past 11. From 12. It's like half an hour. Okay. All right. Vanani says it's actually from 9:30 to 11:30 that the technical committee meets. And then we begin at that point with deliberations whereby we listen to the NPA and its submissions on the trafficking bill. Okay? So thank you very much. We're adjourned.
Thank you for your indulgence.